Golf Smarter Premium, number 486, published on April 28, 2015. Your short game solution. Mastering the short game from 120 yards and in with James Siekman.
This is Golf Smarter Premium. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, James.
Hey, Fred. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure because you've got a brand new book out, just came out last month, it's available on Amazon, called Your Short Game Solution, Mastering the Finesse Game from 120 Yards and In, a favorite topic of the Golf Smarter Podcast.
Well, I think hopefully a favorite topic of anybody that wants to shoot a good score.
And isn't that the case, though? I mean, it really is. And I discovered, I'm not a PGA professional, I just have the right equipment to do these recordings, and I love playing golf, but I'm a weekend player and don't have a ton of time to practice. But I recently discovered in the last year or so how important the short game is. You discovered this a long time ago.
Well, I did, because I mean, I played professionally and I hit the ball beautifully, and you know, it just was a huge competitive disadvantage when I couldn't get the ball up and in, couldn't kind of keep my momentum going in the round. And if you look at the short game, so important for a lot of reasons, but if you look at, just look at it statistically, the best players make the most birdies. And so you'd think about, well, that means, oh, the best ball strikers then would be the best players. But you got to think about where you make your birdies percentage wise. And typically, you're not making them on a 215-yard par 3. You're not making on a 485-yard par 4. You know, you do that once in a while, but it's a bit of an outlier.
Right.
The reality is you make your birdies on the par 5s that you can't reach. You make them on the par 5s that you can reach. You make them on the short par 4s where you can happen to get the ball up there 70 yards from the green. And so that type of shot called a distance wedge is critical for making birdies, and making birdies is critical to being a good player. And of course, if you make birdies, another way to make birdies is to feel like you can shoot at pins. And if you have no confidence in your finesse game around the greens, and you find yourself playing in the middle of the green and, you know, having good shots that end up 30 feet or so. So it really is feeds on itself in so many different ways, as far as just keeping momentum, being able to attack, taking advantage of the easy holes. And if you're not tidy with your wedge game from 120 yards and in, you really do not have a chance to compete.
Right, right. Now, in the book, I loved the story on how you started figuring this out, you with your brother and being on tour, and started videotaping on your own. Why don't you give us a little history of your own game and how you got to understanding and becoming the guru that you are to so many players.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting tale. You know, I played in college. I played nicely. Turned pro afterwards and played. Those days, there was no such thing as a web.com tour or a Hogan tour. It was get all the way through tour school or play overseas or mini tour events. So I went overseas and I played in Asia and South America and did that for about 5 years, traveling around the world playing. Great experience, but it became very clear to me that everything that I was working hard on to improve was actually making me much worse. And I had great touch around the greens when I was a kid, but I had no thoughts either. I just kind of did it. And then as I started to get formal coaching, you know, I got much, much worse. I quit, got married, and took a job working for Dave Pills, who's a kind of a famous short game coach. And after 2 or 3 years there, having an opportunity to kind of learn from him and dabble in a little bit more specifically in short game coaching, had an opportunity to start my own business. And one thing was very clear at that point, even after working, teaching short game schools for 3 years, I had no clue what good technique was. I didn't know what worked and why. I just knew that the things that I was teaching in those schools and the things that I was taught when I was going through college and as a pro were not working. And they were not only not working for me, but they weren't helping for the people I was seeing. So I decided I needed to go on a little bit of a journey or quest to try and figure this out, since I was just getting ready to open my own academy. And my oldest brother, Tom's a PGA Tour player, was on tour for 11 years and was close friends with Seve, among a lot of great players, and asked me to come caddy for him at the Players Championship. So
how exciting.
I had a kind of unique opportunity to be around the best wedge player on the planet, as well as many others like Raymond Floyd and Corey Pavin. And I had a huge need to try and figure out what the heck, you know, what worked and why, because at this point I only knew what didn't work. And, you know, I went and took video and I studied it just like a football coach would study a film of a game, and, you know, kind of wiped the slate clean and just started my own theory. Since I didn't know what to teach, I thought the most logical thing would be to study what they do and actually just teach what they do. And I found it to be amazingly opposite and completely different than anything I'd ever heard.
That's what I found so fascinating is the epiphany that you had when you were doing this. What was it that you discovered? Well, before I ask that question, I just want to announce to the audience that we're live on Periscope right now. And if the people watching on Periscope have any questions that they want to submit to James while we're having this conversation, please type them up on the screen and I'll try to get to them as I can. I already have one question that came in earlier today from Twitter when we announced that I was going to do this interview with you. But tell me about, you know, when you went through the footage, James, what was it that you found? How were you able to get to the place where you're saying, you know, this is very different than anything we're teaching?
Yes. I mean, so, it's different in every single facet. I mean, I could run through and list 70 things that are completely opposite of what you should be doing in your full swing to generate power. And it just kind of came to the realization as the goals change and the goal becomes to be weak, to have a soft touch, to control the speed instead of generate it, to use loft and bounce of the club, that the technique should change right along with the intent. And, you know, I wasn't thinking this far ahead, but after a while I kind of say, well, this makes sense to me now. Why wouldn't it be different? But, you know, the first thing I noticed was that these great players, Seve Ballesteros, Raymond Floyd, whatnot, Corey Pavin, had a little reverse pivot in their backswing, which, you know, they might start with their weight fairly even, which is another difference. I was taught to lean left and, you know, put your hands ahead. That they had their weight even and they reversed weight shifted to add pressure in their left or lead leg a little bit in the backswing. Their head would literally move 2 or 3 inches towards the target. And then as they deliver the club, their head would stay forward. And if you think of a full swing or even a 70-yard shot, as you turn back behind the ball, swing your arms and turn your shoulders, you actually load pressure into your trail leg, and your head typically moves 3 or 4 inches behind the ball. As you deliver, a lot of times to add, especially with a driver, to hit up on it or at least hit it level, as you shift your weight, your body, your upper body tilts back. So the entire motor pattern was different, not only with balance, but with the sequence of events, with the setup, with how they released the club, with the role of the rotation, the arm movement, everything about it was completely opposite. So I just started to just write down the commonalities that Seve had. He was my main guy that I studied because I had the most footage of him and he had the reputation of being the best. But Raymond Floyd and Corey Pavin, my brother, who was an amazing wedge player, and you know, I had Wayne Grady and Jody, a lot of great players that I had this footage of. And I just thought, well, you know what? I don't know what the heck I'm doing. So I guess I'll just write down what they're doing and that's what I'll teach.
And it's worked for you.
It has. It's, you know, it not only worked for me, because now all of a sudden it's like I started to rediscover some of the touch and feel I had when I was young, and I had no thoughts. But the students that I began to teach, once again, when I was working for Dave Pelz, quite honestly, people were not leaving those schools improved, in my opinion. Now, all of a sudden, I really started to see some major growth, some excited phone calls and emails of people telling me how much better they were doing. And, at some point, you need that confirmation as a coach that things are working.
I'm fascinated. You said they weren't improving at schools. Is that the nature of the schools themselves, or was it what was being taught? Because I've talked to so many people who've gone to golf schools, and they feel so great after doing a long weekend or even up to 5 days in a school, and they go home, and without somebody there to, keep correcting them and stuff, they don't remember much, and right. They're very frustrated and feel like they spent money that didn't really turn their game around at all.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, but I would say more than anything, it's just really bad information. And you get bad information on technique, that's bad enough. But unfortunately, those schools don't. To say this appropriately, I would say this: I am a coach. I'm not a teacher. So if you came to me and you needed help, and I said, hey, I'm going to teach you to do this technique, that technique, and we're going to perfect this movement. You could walk away with perfect movement, Fred, but you won't be a better player. Because as a coach, I'm interested only in performance. And so you can improve technically to improve, but you can also make your training time more effective so that you develop skill, which is really what performance is. And that those skills that have nothing to do with technique, they could be picking the right club, picking the right landing spot, adapting for upslopes and downslopes. What do I do, when the ball's into the grain? So that type of stuff was just not being taught. And what's worse is the technical information was poor. What's worse yet is that when you're thinking about technique, the thoughts are internal. And so, Fred, if I could ask you as a recreational player, what's the worst thing you could do on a golf course?
The worst thing that I can do on the golf course is keep repeating the mistakes over and over again.
Well, I would argue that it's thinking too much.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, I'll go with that.
If you overthink in golf, and you especially with internal thoughts, it's so harmful for your game. Great golf is not internal thoughts; it's external. You're picturing you're feeling energy to the target. The thoughts live outside your body, not in. Well, you go to this golf school, you learn this great technique. 100% of the time is focused, have internal thoughts. There's no mention of skill development. There's no mention of how to improve mentally. And it's long and tiring. And you do this for 3 days, you get sent home, and it's no wonder people weren't getting better, because they're going about the process of improving all wrong. There has to be not just this technique that I discovered. I mean, that's great and it works, but more importantly, there has to be an approach to improving, an logical, simple way that you could spend a few minutes each day to get better, to not only improve your technique, but your skill and the confidence of what great golf demands. And that's really what coaches do that teachers do not. They think about the whole picture as opposed to just some little technical tip.
Oh, that's amazing. Actually, I guess the answer to your question is something I'm actually struggling with right now with my putting, is I'm getting in my own way.
Yeah, I got the putting book coming out next year, Fred, so we'll have to do this again in a year.
Okay, great.
But that it's the same, whether it's people get in their own way off the tee, they get in their own way when they chip, they get in their own way when they putt. But if I was going to share with you, that's such a multifaceted, interesting problem. And I do go into great detail in this next one about that very topic, because that's, I think, a very common problem. That might be the most common problem. But if you're getting in your own way, there's two things happening. Once again, thoughts are internal. You're thinking about how to move the club. You're thinking about a position of your head or your arm or the motor of your stroke or what you want the club to do. And I would move your thoughts and train to try, think of external and a kind of a subconscious reaction to what you picture. And the way I do that with my students is I separate training time. So by intent. So if the intent of training is to work on and improve your technique, then we eliminate the hole, we put into open space, and we think of only technique. Those internal thoughts. And we do it in a manner where there's some feedback, whether we know we're doing it right or not. So might just create a simple workstation for your putting or for your wedge play or your bunker play or whatever. And it just might be some swings without the ball or certainly without a pin where we evaluate the technique. Then you just have to flush that completely and you have to think about skill. And so you do that through random practice. Instead of one ball after the other in the same spot, you scatter balls everywhere. You have all your clubs and you go through an organized process to get yourself ready. And in the book, I talk about this process, starting with assessment of the why, the when, the grain, all the factors that would influence it, choosing a club, choosing a trajectory, choosing a landing spot, visualizing the ball go in. So now all of a sudden, as I visualize, the thoughts are external, right? I have my thought walking in, clear and committed, taking a rehearsal swing, thinking of nothing more than kind of energy to your picture, and then reacting like you tied your shoe this morning, Fred, which is you don't know how you did that. You just did it, right?
Just did it. Didn't even think about it.
You can take that approach to putting as well. When you're taking your rehearsal swing or you're over the ball, are you reacting to a vision or are you consciously trying to move the club a certain way? And that's the definition of, to some extent, of getting in your own way, you know? So that's the pre-shot kind of portion of that equation. There's also a post-shot portion where the most important time in golf is what you do after a bad shot. What's the first 5 seconds after a bad shot? How do you react? How do you respond? Well, the typical person, let's say you miss a short putt, you miss a 2-footer.
Oh, you've watched
me play.
The
typical response is people, they get angry, they get frustrated, they get despondent. They go, oh, I can't putt. I'm horrible at this. You know, all the negative self-talk, right? So, that's certainly not making the next one easier, right? That right. Your self-image is taking a big blow every time you say, I can't do this, I'm no good at it, this is frustrating, or just feeling that negative emotion. So that's not what champions do. Champions think about the results unemotionally and allow them to direct them in a positive way so they can do the next one better. So that's literally why I titled my book Your Short Game Solution, because as a coach, I ask the same question probably 500 times a day. And I always ask, okay, what's the solution to that? So Fred, you missed this 2-footer. What's the solution? Well, it could be more break, could be less energy, could be more commitment, could be I didn't quiet my eye and do my breathing or whatever it is that we're working on, right? Mm-hmm. And you say, well, next time I'll just recommit and I'll do that foundational thing better. And so therefore you missed your 2-footer, but you've recommitted in a positive way to your plan, as opposed to missing your 2-footer and going, wow, I suck, I can't putt. And so there's a lot of little pitfalls, mental pitfalls to putting or performance in golf that people just don't quite get right. They just don't quite have the mental discipline or the knowledge to kind of self-coach in a positive way.
So interesting. You know, your book, it's very hard to do in an audio podcast, go over the book in detail because it's such a technical book. And there are great drills in it. There's so much great information that it's the type of thing that you need to go over multiple times. But there are a couple things in the book that I'd like to talk about. And just get your, you know, rough explanation on this and tease the audience to obviously go out and buy the book. And let's talk about the choosing the correct wedges for your game.
Right. So in your set makeup, you know, you're looking for some versatility in the bounce options. Okay. And also, kind of an even gaps total distance between your wedges. So let's just look at those two criteria. You know, if we're talking a distance wedge, which I define as like between 40 yards and maybe your full swing of your pitching wedge. So let's say 125 or whatever. You don't want a bigger gap than about 20 yards in there. So if I hit my pitching wedge to 125, the next club I need to hit at least 95 yards. The next club I need to hit at least 75 full. And if I can get those nice even spread like that, then through this distance wedge system that I expound upon in the book, you can really learn to cover any yardage with appropriate spin and trajectory. Okay, so that's one criteria. The second would be the bounce options and the sole grind, the shape of the wedge. And I mean, that's a book in itself, just kind of going through all the different detail there. But if I could just generalize it to this one point, I think it'd be helpful for anybody listening. You want to have a sand wedge, your middle wedge, whether it's 54, 55, 56, doesn't matter, with a lot of bounce on it. Bounce is the difference between the bottom back of the club on the sole to the leading edge in degrees. So a typical good sand wedge, you might have between 10 and 14 or 15 degrees of bounce on it. If you have a more lofted club, like a 58, 59, or 60, you want that one to be low in bounce. So probably between 4 and 7, depending once again on your standard technique. So with the techniques that I try and get people to use, you don't need much bounce because the swing's very shallow and you use it as you swing. So if that's the case and you have a high bounce sand wedge and a low bounce lob wedge, then you're really prepared for any turf condition, because when the sand or grass is soft, kind of like it usually is in the Northeast or maybe up there in the Northern California or whatever, you kind of soft conditions, the ball comes out slow and more bounce is better than less. So you can always use your sand wedge. Perfect. You need a little bit more energy. You need more bounce. If on the other hand, you're playing kind of tight, firm turf, like you get in a lot of places, whether it's Texas or maybe it's just have a little bit of a drought going on the course or whatever, or firm sand that's been where it's rained and it's kind of packed in and baked, then you need less bounce is more effective and the ball comes out fast or flies off. So you need more loft and less bounce. So you always have a choice if you have that set makeup.
Awesome. That's
does that make sense? It does. Topic.
But. Yeah, it is. But there was a line, it's almost not a throwaway, but it was kind of buried in there that I also thought is actually perfect for what Golf Smarter is all about for this podcast and how we approach golf here. Well, how I approach golf. And that is bad decisions versus bad shots.
Yeah, there are certain conditions or trajectories that you might play based on the lie. And of course, this is skill. Once again, this is not technique. It's a judgment. And so the most common one that I see is a ball laying into the grain on a tight lie. And in that case, a lot of people, they may have their favorite club out, which is a lob wedge, and they might see a little lower shot with it because they have some green to work with. So they lean the shaft a little forward and they take this club. When you lean the shaft forward, you reduce the effective bounce and you sharpen the leading edge, which is just an awful thing to do into the grain, where if you hit just a little behind it with a sharp leading edge, it's just going to dig a trench. And you, I mean, we all saw that. I think the listeners, you think back at Tiger at the Hero World Challenge, where he's into the grain on that sticky Bermuda and he's digging the leading edge in the ground, just duffing shot after shot. That is much about, that certainly was technique in his case, but it's more about shot selection. And so if you take your sand wedge and just roll back the clock to 1970, pre-lob wedge, and take your sand wedge, and we could hit the same trajectory shot as we did with the 60 by hitting a little higher than normal shot with that sand wedge. And effectively, you add bounce and soften the leading edge, and it just works so much better. Now, the problem is that skill development, that judgment element, requires decision making and training. How are you supposed to learn that? How did I learn that? You know, well, the way I learned it is that I trained properly by throwing balls everywhere and learning through experience of a bunch of different trials. But that's not what the average golfer does. Even at my own club, you think these people would have read the book and known better or whatever, but they go out to the short game area. They stand in the same spot for 20 minutes and they'll hit 10 shots to one pin, then they'll hit 10 shots to the next pin, and they're all from the same lie, and they tee them up. And it's just horrible practice for trying to develop skill and learn the little nuances of being a great player.
And what would you walk up to them and have them do if...
I would not. I would just say, you know what? The reality is, if they're not going to practice properly, they're better off just going to have a beer, because they're probably doing more harm than good at that point.
Interesting.
You know, think about it. When you're in a pile, you hit a bad shot, what do? Well, you think internally about what you did wrong, and then you fiddle and you try something new. And then at some point, you stay there long enough, you're going to hit a shot you don't like. You know, there's no resiliency in it. There's no toughness in it. There's no skill development in it. And so they're just better off just like skipping it altogether.
Yeah. Interesting. You mentioned Tiger, and that kind of leads into the question that did come across on Twitter today from Nick at Golf Progress. What did you see in Tiger's wedge play that was so radically different between Augusta and Phoenix?
Yeah, well, let's just backtrack a little. Let's say what was so radically different between Phoenix and what he did in 2000.
Okay.
His technique in 2000, when he was at the top of his powers there, was spotless, very fundamentally sound. That his technique in Phoenix and before was just absolutely awful. Everything awful of... the setup was bad. He's backing up in the middle of his motion. The backswing was wrong. And you think, how could a person of that talent regress that far? And the reality is, the only way to get that far is to work hard on the wrong things. So he got some bad information at some point, practiced it diligently, wasn't quite getting what he wanted out of it, and the whole thing regresses. And in this case, I know for a fact that the changes he was making in his backswing, with the way he moved his arms, he's working on his full swing, first with Haney and then with Sean Foley, that the arm movements, the motor patterns that he was working on hard changed that dramatically. He just kind of crept into his finesse game. He was literally moving his arms exactly the same way. And that ultimately ended up making him change his setup and the whole motor pattern. So that's a very common mistake. The major premise of my book is that the full swing and short game are opposites. They're not the same. And if you use the same motor pattern for both, you'll only be good at one. You just got to pick your one you want to be good at, I guess.
I was very surprised when I came across that part in the book. Is like, whoa, wait, completely different swings on your short game versus.
Different. Now I should say, finish that comment, I guess.
Sure.
Tiger's new coach, Chris Como, smart guy, friend of mine, has a ton of knowledge, and he inherited this issue with Tiger. He didn't create it. So I think the reality is, I think that was a shocker as a coach when he shows up and he's working on full swing and to find out that his player can't chip. kind of found that out after the fact. And then I think given, you know, then Tiger takes a break and they sit there and they focused on that part of the game and worked it through. And I think now the difference at Augusta is just operating with good information. Hmm. And everything has changed. Like setup's completely different. Backswing arm movement pattern's different. His balance and the way he releases the club was completely different. So 100% technique.
Interesting. Yeah, it's. I've asked a number of different coaches that we've had on the show if you had the chance to talk to Tiger for 15 minutes or, you know, if he called you and said, would you help me, what would you do? And so many have said, just go back to what got you here in the first place. Stop playing with it.
Yeah, but how do you do that? I mean, it's like putting the toothpaste back into the tube once you squeeze it out. It's just like... it's impossible. Motor patterns have changed. Your motor memories have changed. You know, everything's different. So you just like the reality is that's why you got to have foundational beliefs. They need to be well-defined. You got to have ways to train so that you never really degenerate or get lost and move away from them. And I think that's really what happened when he switched kind of coaches, he switched complete concepts of how to do it. And then at some point he didn't know. He's kind of like me when I was teaching. It's like, well, I don't know what's right, but I know that's wrong, you know? So
so tell us where you're teaching now. And if people wanted to reach out and work with you, where they would go and how they would get in touch with you.
Yeah, well, I have a golf academy in Omaha, Nebraska, at Shadow Ridge Country Club. The easiest way to get a hold of me would be to send me an email. Just go to my website, jsegolfacademy.com. And there's a place where they can kind of see some tips and do all those sort of things, but also a place where they can contact me. I'm not here very often. I work, I'm on an airplane pretty much every week.
Wow.
Working with tour players and doing different things. And, but I'm usually here, you know, 2 or 3 days a week. And, you know, if they want to bad enough, we can certainly find a way to get together.
All right. Listen, I'm going to break for a couple of announcements. And then when we come back, I'd like to, have you give us a little tip that I'm going to record on video as well. So we can use that on our Golf Smarter TV channel on YouTube and then, also promote it on Facebook and whatnot. So can we, come back in just a minute? You got an idea for a tip?
Sure, absolutely.
I've thought a lot about not including sponsor messages in our premium episodes, but if there's a discount available to Golf Smarter listeners, I don't want you to be left out. But between the two of us, I'm not going to include all the commercial information that the advertiser provides. And I'm not even going to report to them that this show has the ad. So let me just tell you that we have a new sponsor this week called Casper. They're an online mattress company that offers you an obsessively engineered mattress that incorporates both latex and memory foam made in the United States. They give you free delivery and a no-hassle return period of 100 days. More than anything, that's what I wanted to share with you. Try out one of their mattresses for 100 days, and if you don't like it, return it. Doesn't that make more sense than trying a mattress out in a showroom for 100 seconds? Plus, when you use the promo code GOLF, you'll get an additional $50 off the purchase price. A king-size mattress is only $950, which is a great price to start, and that doesn't even include your exclusive discount. Check out the homepage they created for Golf Smarter listeners at casper.com/golf and use the promo code GOLF for an additional $50 off. All right, James, thank you very much for waiting and repositioning yourself and your iPad so that we can see you. How about giving us a quick tip right from the book? Again, it's your short game solution, mastering the finesse game from 120 yards and in. Why don't you give us a quick tip from the book?
Yeah, one of the key issues around the green, especially inside 30 yards, is to sequence your swing properly. And there is a power sequence where you start your downswing with your body, some shift and some lateral, and your hands move faster in the club, and you get this little down cock, so you get this little whip down there. Well, The short game is opposite. So I call it a finesse sequence. And the easiest way to learn what the finesse sequence is, which is essentially at the start of your downswing, the club moving faster than your arms at the start of the downswing, so these angles are starting to be let out, is to chip with your trail arm only, and just in training. So I just pretend like essentially like I have a ball in my hand, which I'm going to grab here. And if I was going to do a little underhanded toss, I wouldn't do it by starting my hips. I'd start my arm, the club would come out, and then I'd just release the club past my body to get this nice, gentle little toss there. And it's the same motion. The only thing I'm going to do differently is I'm going to do it with the club in my hand. So just grip the club in the trail arm only. Set up to it as normal. I really like to level out, so I like to put my left hand kind of down on my thigh. And I'm just going to make a one-handed swing, just pretending like I'm doing a little five-yard toss with my trail hand. And that gives you the perfect sequence as you release the club past your body. And I get a lot of calls and or texts saying, oh, I chip so beautifully one hand only doing your drill, but when I put my left hand on there, it's not quite as good. It's just the perfect drill that allows you to sequence your swing properly, release the club past your body, and nice soft touch around the greens.
Fabulous tip. Thank you. And I'm just so impressed that you can hit balls around the house and not get in trouble.
Oh, yeah. My wife's out of town. That's the only reason.